one of the things that has become central to conversations around identity in the social justice world in the last decade or two has been a growing recognition of something that has been appearing in many different fields throughout the 20th and early 21st century. In a funny way, it's a social version of the insight of quantum mechanics. The insight in early quantum mechanics was that you can't measure something without influencing it, right? You can't actually know the position of a particle without stopping it. And what that translated to, and metaphorically was very useful, was that there's no removed observer position. There's no place that you can observe something happening from where you don't influence it. Okay? But this knocks down some of the deepest ideas of the scientific world, right? That it's possible somehow to observe nature from this kind of, you know, remove that is somehow neutral, that doesn't have a position. And in so many of the fields, this has been uprooted. You know, within anthropology, there's been a whole turn toward recognizing that when an anthropologist from, you know, let's say a wealthy urban culture goes to live with a bunch of folks in, you know, let's say an agrarian or hunter-gatherer tribal situation, they're not observing that thing as it was without them there. It's impossible to do so, right? They become part of what's being observed. Some of this, this has come out in so many ways. There was a film made in the kind of late 19th, early 20th century. There was a researcher who was researching the Inuit tribes in Alaska and Canada, the Yukon territories, and up in the Yukon, I think. I might get the story slightly wrong. Who went to live with them for a long time and really was, you know, quite a respectful and embedded in the culture researcher, but still was, you know, this wealthy white researcher from outside coming in, and eventually made a film about these folks and their life, filming hunting and igloo building and dancing and singing and the life of this whole tribe, and it was hugely influential. It was part of both a momentum toward, you know, setting aside more land for indigenous groups, directing resources their way, but also bringing more attention their way and bringing more kind of tourism in a certain way their way. And what came out over the years was that this film that seemed like a documentary, like this is a film of these people doing their thing, with no mention of the filmmaker, of course turns out to be a deep collaboration. There's one scene where the Inuit are killing this, what was it? It was like a walrus or something, like at the seashore, huge animal. They're really trying to take it down with like harpoons and ropes and this very non-technological method. And it's sort of the action climax of the film, right? Here are these incredible indigenous folks doing this ancient hunting technique. And it looks great, and everyone's like, oh, you know, this is part of the noble savage period. Lots of problems in here. But eventually it comes out that he had them do it a couple times to get the right camera angle, and then the filmmaker and his people were standing right there with rifles. And that the Inuits were kind of like, dude, help us out. And he was like, no, no, it has to look like this in order to be authentic. Which is both true and totally not true or ethical or correct in some, in various ways. This is just one of so many examples that has turned out to point to this thing that has really blossomed now. And the word we started with a couple weeks ago is positionality. And that's kind of a jargon term from critical theory. But it basically says that who you are or the position you stand in influences not only the situation that you're in, which should be obvious, but it also profoundly influences the way that you yourself can even understand what's going on. And we could think of it using any number of examples. I'll use a gender example that no matter how deeply I educate myself as a cisgendered man, someone who was assigned the gender of male at birth and who feels comfortable within that assignment, more or less, the way that I understand the world is going to be colored by that in ways that I simply won't be able to understand the world as described by someone with a different experience, a woman or a trans person. Or even a man from another, you know, framework, another culture, another time, another class, all the details. What the teaching on positionality really begins with is that there's no neutral anywhere. There's no objective place. But what this does is it undercuts the illusion that any particular place could be a neutral or objective standpoint. And the people who generally claim that there could be a neutral or objective standpoint are generally the ones in power. So you could think of, like, what's the norm? One of my teachers who does beautiful work on this, Ruth King, starts her workshop on this material with a list of kind of relatively ordinary things to classify yourself within. You know, are you left-handed or right-handed? Let's say. You know, do your eyes discern colors or are you colorblind? That kind of thing. And the list is really, you know, fairly simple, or ordinary things. But then she goes in and says, go down the list and mark which of those two things has the cultural power or the cultural norm. Right? So, like, you're right-handed or left-handed, or maybe bi. Handed and bidextrous. But do we all know which of those has cultural power? Right? Like, right-handedness has a kind of norm in our culture that where there's a tiny, maybe tiny, maybe not, I'm speaking from the position of a right-hander. So I'm like, oh, it's insignificant. Right? My wife as a left-hander would say it's not insignificant, the oppression of the left-handedness. Or maybe oppression is a strong word, but the stigma, in some way, it's not random that left-handed, left is the word gauche in French, meaning, you know, kind of awkward. And another word for the left hand is sinister. Right? In in the Indian tantric traditions, the right-handed path is the one that keeps the traditional precepts of purity and only visualizes in a kind of very metaphorical way the imbibing of forbidden substances and engaging with sexuality in non-normative ways. But then there's the left-handed path that actually does those things literally, flouts the social norms, eats the wrong things, has sex with the wrong people, really pushes the edge or goes way beyond it. The right hand is the conventional and the left hand is the wild, the unconventional, the dangerous. So left-handers, you know something in your position as a left-hander that I as a right-hander don't know. But if I, in my right-handedness, rest into right-handedness being the norm, I'm going to set up a culture in which my position as a right-hander is powerful and unquestioned. And the teaching on positionality says that the important thing to do for liberation is to see that and be willing to act in accordance with my ethics around that. So, like, basically, if I can't see it, I'm deluded. I'm going to act in ways that perpetuate a power imbalance because I think a certain thing is the norm. This comes right into the basic ethical vow that is at the heart of the yogic practices. Right? Both Buddhism and yoga begin, in a sense, practice with the first of the five precepts, which is the precept against harming. And both contain this powerful injunction to wake up from ignorance and delusion. Ignorance, almost by definition, the word is avidya, not knowing, absence of knowledge, wrong knowledge in some ways, wrong perception, leading to clouded vision, clouded knowing. By definition, is to not see something that's true. So if I took this example, right-handedness, left-handedness, if I don't see that there are concepts or ideas associated with this social difference, whether it's biological or social or cultural, and that bound up in that is harm, particularly, you know, like if you just go and buy a pair of scissors and you forget to get the special left-handed scissors, they don't necessarily work. They're getting better at that nowadays. But when I was a kid, it was really like, oh, it just doesn't work. It doesn't cut the paper because it depended on being right-handed. So that's an innocuous example, I say, from the position of a right-hander. But isn't a huge part of what our culture is waking up to right now the problems that exist when folks from a certain position that holds cultural power assume that their position is the norm, structure everything to preserve their power, mostly unconsciously, and assume that what is actually an artificial power imbalance is nature, is just rightness. This is what happens when, you know, when patriarchy is assumed and not questioned, you know. You know, that that a panel of, you know, 16 old white men could determine the fate of women's reproductive rights for the next century without a single woman being on the panel. In this current instance, Dianne Feinstein is on that panel. Go, Dianne. May everyone be strong. But like, positionality says, like, oh, the danger here is not actually that these men are evil. Some of them, I think, might be, depending on how you define it. But actually, the danger is that many of them will be blind, will be ignorant, will have avidya, will not see that their position, their very position, is colored by something that they might not believe in. Like, they might actually believe in equality, but not realize that their position makes it impossible for them to recognize what equality is. The reason I love the teaching on positionality as a powerful guide for action is that it shines a light on one of the deepest places where avidya, or ignorance, lives in us, which is ignorance of our own conditionality, our own conditions. The inquiry question is basically, take anything that you think of as the norm and tell yourself that it's not the norm, that that's a viewpoint that you hold based on your background. And even take really beautiful norms. You know, if you say, if you grew up saying, as I did, I think people are basically good. That's my general MO. I think people are basically good. Confused, but more or less good. I think that's mostly right. It's a good teaching. It helps me to give people the benefit of the doubt and be kind and all sorts of things. But if I actually ask myself, is that universally true? Or could that be a product of my position, my conditions? One of the things I will notice is that my position is relatively privileged. In a host of kind of standard oppression categories, I tilt on the privileged side, or the empowered side of several of them. I'm right-handed. I'm cisgendered. I'm more or less straight, and I look that way anyway. I married a woman. I'm more or less white, even though I'm not, but I mostly look that way. I'm learning how to say that I'm not. It's a mysterious path. Mixed race, adopted, raised by white people. I think I'm white. But I was raised white, and so I feel like I'm white. People treat me with a lot of privilege. That's mysterious. But as in a lot of these things with gray areas, it's important for positionality, for instance, in that particular one for me, to see that it's mixed, but to be as clear as I can about where power really lies. And it turns out that my, you know, maleness and mostly straightness and mostly whiteness has come together into a significant amount of privilege. It's really important not to say that this is a blame or like that this makes me wrong in some way. It's really just a description. It just makes me privileged. But what I want to see then is that, let's say this idea, you know, people are basically good. If I interrogate that from the perspective of privilege, I might recognize that one of the things that privilege gives one is comfort. That's probably the primary thing it gives one. Like, I was raised more or less not threatened physically, more or less not threatened emotionally. Or you could just say, people were nice to me as a child, and etc. So those are conditions in which one could maintain the idea that people are generally good. But of course, I know enough now, I've read enough news and met enough people in the real world to know that there's all sorts of people whose situation is far less privileged, far more dangerous, and who don't actually share the view that people are generally good. And all this means, this doesn't mean that we get to decide that one of the views is right. The whole point of this is that we get to recognize that none of the views are right in any objective way, but that they're views. And that the view and the being of the person holding them, the experience of the person holding them, can't be separated. That's really the teaching on positionality, and it weaves profoundly into the Buddhist teaching on the nature of the self. The beautiful teaching on the nature of the self says, I can't separate myself as an individual from anything else. But that means that I can't maintain the illusion of my autonomy. The idea that I'm somehow independent and, you know, I make all my own choices. I'm separate. Things happen, but I'm separate. It feels like that sometimes, but I think that's a feeling. It's not a defensible reality. Anywhere I look, what I see is connection. In any of the great categories, I see connection. And in every detail of who I am, I see connection. And so we get this teaching that right now is showing up in a beautiful way, I think, in our culture, challenging very, very, very deep norms of how American culture, European American culture, global post-industrial culture organizes itself. And it's challenging the norms that should not be norms. Things that were norms because a certain group of people was in power for a while, and this was just how they liked it, or how conditions beyond even their control had come into being. And so the big movements of our time, the Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, are unfolding within a practice of deep inquiry into positionality. Right? The conference that we're putting on next month, it was immediate in the organizational meetings that the folks putting it on, who are a mix of white folks, people of color, Westerners, Easterners, said, oh, part of what we want to do is recognize who each of us are in wanting to do this and to act in a way that's in accord with our values, understanding who we are. So, for instance, we're not going to put on a conference about white privilege with only white people speaking from the front of the room. Right? We're going to do it differently. But to do it differently, that means we have to know who we are. We have to do the positionality work to say, oh, here's where I'm coming from. What can I not see from my position? And a huge part of this then means, like, oh, things that I can't see, I need to know that I can't see them. You can't see someone else's position, so you have to talk to them. It's like, oh, I don't know what it's like to be a South Asian person in American yoga. Right? I have all sorts of things to say about cultural appropriation and yoga and the history. I know hella Indian yogic history. But, you know, how many actual Indian, South Asian people do I know within the yoga community? At this point, I know a bunch, but not hardly as many as I know white folks. So if I want to know what it's like, I have to ask them. I have to be like, come, talk, if you want to. Be in this conversation. And so I think of this as a deep exercise, unpacking avidya, really trying to bring light to that which forms my being, but is by its nature occluded or veiled or can't be seen. I quote this often because I think it's awesome, and also just because I miss him culturally. David Foster Wallace gave a talk at a graduation. It went viral a bunch of years back, before he died. And it was made into this kind of awesome little video little slightly animated video. It's really a video about waking up to how everyone is suffering and the need for kindness. But it starts off with a story about two fish swimming around in some water. They're talking about whatever. And along comes a bigger fish, an older fish, a wise fish. Comes along and it's like, hey guys. And they're like, hey. And the big fish says, how's the water? And swims off. And the one little fish says to the other little fish, what's water? So positionality work is to recognize water, basically. Like, oh, what's this thing I swim in? Like, oh, this is privilege, or oh, this is the perspective of the of, you know, my gender or my race or my class. In the yogic systems, we could say, oh, it starts there. The yogic systems, I think, actually assume that. They assume that you know what caste you come from or what family you come from. It doesn't even get discussed much, partly because the societies were much more fixed than ours is. But from there, the question of position goes very deep. And the inquiry really becomes like, what are the deep belief systems that I take for granted? You know, like that things are solid. It starts to say, oh, I'm just assuming that this is a teacup because I am a being of a certain positionality. And my positionality is that I'm a person who has thirst and I like tea and, you know, so I just take this for granted. I'm like, yeah, teacup. But that's not a description of reality. That's a description of a perspective that is biased. But a different creature. You know, like a raccoon looking for a little bowl carrying some water to wash its bit of old strawberry in. It's not a teacup. Or whatever, the minute it breaks, what is it? Oh, it's trash, right? It's like, no, well, it's clay, right? It's earth. It's, and any position you take, any positionality you take, it's a different experience. And so then we get reflections on, like, the cardinal elements that say things like, don't perceive it as any particular conditioned thing, but just get as basic as you can. It's like, oh, it's earth and water and heat and wind. Like, that's it. And then relate to it from those perspectives and break down your position in a very, very deep way. So I'll propose to end that the challenging teaching of positionality in the social world right now is actually, and this may be me being hopeful, which is one of the characteristics of my given position, that I have access to that emotion sometimes. My hope is that the social movement toward positionality is the beginning of a deeper culture-wide spiritual unfolding toward vidya, toward knowledge, toward wisdom, and away from avidya, seeing things more clearly, and seeing particularly the demons that haunt us and cause oppression and harm to continue generation after generation, for those to be seen and just ended. The way that when something is really seen, it has the chance of being ended. It was only a couple generations of abolitionists before slavery was illegal, most places where it had been the norm. And it continued in other forms, but that was huge. And what it took was people waking up to something that was thought of as the norm, but of course should not be. And as soon as they saw that and said, you know, what is this? This is terrible. That spread like wildfire and through a lot of hard work and fighting, shifted the norm. So I think this is foundational for our spiritual practice and for our ethical practice in the world right now. So here's a little exercise or reflection, and then we'll chat a bit together. Think for a moment. If I was to say, like, tell me a bit about yourself, in a kind of casual way. We're out, you know. We're meeting at the somewhere, you know, a very nice coffee house or the Climate March or some other groovy place that, you know, whatever people of our position might find each other in, at a yoga studio. And I might say, like, oh, tell me a little bit about yourself. What do you like? And think about kind of the first few sort of defining qualities or categories that you might use. You might speak about your work or the kind of person you are. But also think about the kind of background qualities that you're bringing forward. Some way that you might be saying something about, like, your social class or your upbringing or your heritage. The question really is, what are the categories you use to define yourself? And this could be a very deep inquiry, but think of just one or two ways that you think about who you are. And then choosing one, or you could do this a little bit with a couple of them, see if you can sense the perspective that quality or that aspect of your identity gives you in the culture around you. What does it offer you to be this kind of person? And just see if you can sense into what things you see clearly being this kind of person and what things you don't, or you might not have access to, really, being this kind of person. Sometimes it can help to think about someone who is quite different from you in this particular quality or defining characteristic, and to wonder, like, oh, what might it be like to be them? And to realize that you don't know. You can't know, in a way, really what that's like. The last question is a little bit open-ended because it's difficult to know what we don't know. But the question is something like, what might be important to see that I simply can't see from this position, from this quality or identity? What's something that might be important to see or know or realize that I can't see clearly from this position?
think mm-hmm. you and I are the only people who were here 2 weeks ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to take a turn?
I'm good for now. You can go for it.
Yeah, what do you think?
Again.
Oh, yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, no, go for it. What's it like?
Well, I was going through different things that I wanted to say.
Hmm.
First is, maybe you did dial it back a little bit. And
right.
I wasn't sure where you did it. That's not my
yeah.
Then, the other thing that was coming to my mind was that when we have the positionality as it is, which is we inherit so much that we don't own anything. We're just agent of our conditioning, our bringing. I forgot to tell you exactly
mm-hmm.
that thing was
mm-hmm.
a blast in my family
mm.
when you spoke about river.
Yeah.
Do you remember what
yeah.
I'm referring to?
Yeah.
That idea is so simple and yet so laser sharp to say that my lineage, now if I go up, my answer to the question
mm-hmm.
is, especially with the Kol Nidre, Yom Kippur last is I'm just a ring in a chain.
Yeah.
And if I want my ring to ripple,
mm-hmm.
right, I want to grow, die, and have my children take my living. My living will go through my children, basically,
yeah.
is how I took this interpretation. So if we are talking about positionality, and we don't know what we own,
yeah.
or we actually can't claim that we own unless we create something that is going to go through the generation from the Beatles
mm-hmm.
to Elvis Presley.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to create that continuity even though they're not here.
Well, I mean, you just spoke of, you know, chanting the Kol Nidre. Talk about continuity. You know, the old prayers, like, wow, that's continuity, right? Something every generation,
yes.
century after century, chanting, like, wow, that's linked.
Yeah, but
yeah.
I'm just the ring.
Yeah.
So if we are to answer the question, what can you say about yourself? I find it very, difficult. I don't know what I don't know. I
mm-hmm.
just don't know what it is actually that is unique to my own delivery as far as characteristics.
Yeah.
Because I'm humble enough to say that I'm female and I'm right-handed and I'm married and I am analytical and I'm emotional, but all of those
mm-hmm.
things are probably defined for me at my age because I was raised in a certain way and inherited messages. I mean, I look
mm-hmm.
in the mirror, I see my eyes, I see my mouth.
Yeah, trippy, huh?
Trippy.
So trippy, yeah. Well, I look at my son, he looks exactly like me. When, like, we have a picture of me at one and him at one, and it's just like the same kid, except that he's blonde. And it's, that part is incredible, that part of what positionality points toward is the emptiness of this individual. But that the rings
yeah.
that connect all the way back,
mm-hmm.
part of what seeing position can suggest might be something like, oh, there's not actually a separate thing here, but, you know, I embody all of this that I've inherited,
mm-hmm.
all of the suffering, all of the strengths
mm-hmm.
of my people.
Mm-hmm.
Who are my people? Like, some of this folds, as I talked about a couple weeks ago, right into ancestor work.
Mm-hmm.
Who are we?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what am I passing on to my child
mm-hmm.
to head off into the future?
Mm-hmm.
You know, unknown. And
so that's a responsibility.
That's part of the all of this, in a sense, comes back to responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
because if I'm unconscious of what I carry, mm-hmm. I will pass it on. I will act from it.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm conscious of it, I can at least have the possibility of making a choice in relation to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I tell a story often of a dear friend of mine who is a father of a young, two kids now, but he said this when he was a father of just one, a young boy, and he had been abused by his father, who had been abused by his father, who had been abused by his father, and he had been working to process that and heal that in his own system, you know, for years, and he finally had a son, and he looked at him, and he could feel his entire system just like struggling to be healthy, essentially, to be well. And he says that, you know, he made this vow kind of on his life. He said, it stops with me. That whole chain of abuse and harm. And, you know, and we know that the momentum of that kind of thing is so powerful, though. So it's like, you know, may it be so. Like, may he have all the support in the world mm-hmm. to stop it. Because that's how karma and becoming keeps going. So exactly this thing, this mm-hmm. is so strong. And so this says, like, just keep bringing it to light. Mm-hmm. You know, and see, like, who are my people? What's our ancestry? What do we bring?
Mm-hmm.
What can I not know because these are my people rather than these?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. I don't know if this was the dialed back version, but, you know, I tried not to mention, you know, the eternal unfolding of cosmic karma and the absence of self quite as specifically, but you got it anyway. Any other reflections as we went through? Any other things that arise for you here?
It's more a question.
Yeah.
The reflection, I was listening very intently, and I find your words very wise and very soothing, but I'm not always so reassured when I hear about volitionality.
Mm-hmm.
It's, in my limited experience, it's sometimes more fraught
mm-hmm. than
we just have the chance to hear here.
Yeah.
And I'll say this as a statement, but it's a question.
Yeah.
It's an open-ended question. One of the things that intrigues and sometimes troubles me is the confusing of privilege with oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And if I talk from my limited and biased perspective, from my
mm-hmm.
position, privilege is something to enjoy and to wish upon everybody,
mm-hmm.
Not something to trash or to bring down or
mm-hmm.
destroy. And I think that sometimes gets confused in the, say, the ongoing current discourse.
Mm-hmm.
That privilege, particularly when it's attached to white privilege as something
sure.
evil,
sure.
that causes trouble to most everybody else. As you were saying, you know, I come from my own background and experience. I haven't always been privileged in life.
Yeah.
And yet I consider myself very lucky.
Yeah.
I have treasured friends and family members.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's easy for me to say that. But if we can go back to that, what I think is a confusion.
Yeah.
Osama, between privilege and oppression.
Yeah. Yeah. First of all, the first word in the first sentence that you said was like, you know, this isn't always reassuring, and I was, and you know, I'm a little bit like, it's not reassuring. It's not. It's a difficult teaching. It's actually meant to anything that's trying to uproot ignorance is actually meant in a certain way to increase discomfort rather than increase comfort, because it's comfortable to not see things. And so to see things that are painful is uncomfortable. So that's the nature of the teaching. I think it's true that in the current discourse, privilege is sometimes getting conflated with oppression in a way. I think of this essentially as a kind of medicinal or a sort of necessary corrective to blindness. Because what it's trying to do is shine a light on the ways that privilege is a condition for oppression to come to be. it's that doesn't mean that individuals who bear privilege are necessarily themselves oppressors in any given moment. So, like, I have a fair amount of privilege, but I can act in ways that are oppressive, or I can act in ways that are not oppressive. And I can practice doing the not oppressive. So it's not necessarily the case that my privilege is oppressive, but culturally it's the case that privilege tends to support systems of oppression simply because it tends to support blindness. And so this teaching is specifically pointed toward recognizing the ways that privilege supports oppression. Privilege in and of itself is value neutral. It's neither a good thing nor a bad thing. The way that I define privilege is support and safety were offered to one in the past. And I define it as the opposite of trauma, where danger and harm were offered to one in the past. And so we all had a mix of those two things. Some folks had lots of harm and danger. Some folks had lots of help and safety. And help and safety becomes privilege when we think of it just as a gift. Like, no one personally did anything to deserve help or safety. It was just a product of conditions. Right? And so it's to be enjoyed, but it's also to be recognized that it has effects. And so what I would want, very much agreeing with you, what I would want everyone to experience is more help and safety and less harm and danger. And so in that sense, I would say, yes, I would want everyone to have more privilege in that way. I wonder, this is maybe an open question, if help and safety are offered within a belief system or a cultural framework in which they are not, there's no assumptions around them. Do they continue to be privileged in the same kind of way, like that has an oppressive sting? In other words, part of what creates oppression in my own upbringing is that I assumed that safety, let's say, was the norm. I grew up in a relatively safe white suburb, and I just figured that people, broadly, were kind of just safe to be interested in whatever they were interested in. You know, for me, that happened to be play the violin, play a lot of Dungeons and Dragons, you know, and read books and assume I would go to college. Right? Those are privileges. And they're totally neutral, relatively speaking, except that I was blind to the fact that only a few people had access to them. And so that's where the oppression lies. And so the teaching is just to wake up to something that's already there, embedded in it, not necessarily to demonize comfort or to demonize a person that has received that comfort. But very much that's a line that takes some unpacking to walk. And it's normal, I think, in a culture when something difficult comes to light that it gets somewhat over-amplified for the first generation, and then it settles into, you know, a mellower stream. So that's a bit there. Thank you. But anything else? Yeah.
Last. Do you think then that privilege is a finite thing? Like, I guess my question is, if the goal is everyone is privileged because privilege feels great, do some people have to relinquish their privilege voluntarily in order for others to live with health and safety and other privileges like that? Because I think that's where, in my mind at least, that's where it can easily be confused with oppression.
Sure.
Like, you're just skipping along enjoying your privilege.
Right, that's the part.
Even if you're aware that you're
even if you're aware.
Enjoying your privilege.
Right. Now, that's the part that becomes oppressive. In a certain way, if I define privilege as, you know, help and safety, then ideally, particularly the help, like the relational support part, I like to think that everyone could, in some abstract way, have that. Everyone comes from a family of some kind. Those families could be healthier, therefore there could be more privilege everywhere. But if privilege has anything to do with, like, material resources, then it's clear at this point that everyone can't have it. Like, there's not enough. So we live on an earth where for everyone to live like a middle-class American would take 9 planet Earths worth of material resources. So there's simply not enough, clean food, fossil fuels, whatever your metric is of things that create comfort to go around. And so in that sense, access to those is always going to create oppression until our collective of people somehow figures out how to share resources more equitably. So privilege, where privilege means access to resources, will always be unequal. And in that sense, it's not something that can always be shared. I would always want to recognize that as, if we're talking about access to resources, there's always going to be some kind of disparity. Therefore, oppression and power has to be watched out for and, kept in check as best we can. So in that sense, no. Privilege is not a thing that can just be like, everyone can trip along and enjoy it. It actually means, it's actually a word for the folks who have comfort in a system where not everyone can have comfort. And so that always wants to be recognized and adjusted for as best we can.
Doesn't assume that it's mostly about power and money. There might be other norms or other perspectives, other ways of being in life. Mm-hmm. Privilege is not only, or perhaps not even mostly, about power and money.
Sure.
As someone who's enjoying the privilege of having a comfortable middle class, I'm asking that question.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's... I wouldn't want any conversation like this to become a framework for categorically deciding that there's a certain thing that's, allowable, and other things that are not allowable or should be critiqued. It's about bringing consciousness to that which might be unconscious. So, like, the way that you're framing things is a positionality awake way. You're saying, I'm saying this from the position of one who has middle class comfort at the moment, but also from the position of one who has not always had that. And so recognizing that those are the conditions that shape what you're bringing is the thing that will allow you to have the wisdom that this points toward. So when you can say, oh, I come from a middle-class background, but I know that other folks don't, therefore, I know that as I'm doing things. And that's going to change your actions if you really are awake to that, to the degree that any of us are awake to that. If I know where I'm coming from, it'll just change my actions, in any number of ways. I might use fewer material resources, power or money. I might recognize that, like, emotional attunement is also a resource that was a privilege. Like, to have caregivers that really paid attention to a child and gave them love and attention, that's a privilege that some folks don't have. And again, I think the main practice is just to take anything that we think of as the norm off the pedestal called norm. And so to say, like, oh, emotional attunement, that is the norm or should be the norm, and therefore not having that is a mistake. We could reframe that as saying, oh, it's a privilege to have good emotional attunement as a child, and it's a suffering or a trauma not to have that. And so now can we act in ways that just hold that into, take that into account as we go forward? We'll go on in this direction and in others. When you say, like, oh, it's not just about power and money, it's true, it's not. And this is a hint toward a topic that I'll talk about at some point, which is the work of the great Thai monastic reformer Ajahn Buddhadasa and his work on Buddhist socialism. And his contention that taking the Buddhist ethics seriously means a radically redistributive social ethic around money. So we'll get to that at some point. Thank you for being here, for this conversation, and for feeling into it with all of your sincerity.